The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix Podcast. Tune in today.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Kia ora and welcome to The Fold. Only it's not actually The Fold. I'm Duncan Grieve, but I'm just going to just talk for a very short time and then get out of the way, because what I've decided to do this week is actually give up The Fold feed to what I was actually thinking about doing already. It's budget week, if you haven't already heard, and I'm actually recording this in the past. I'm a few hours away from heading down to Wellington to go into the lockup and experience the whole, cloak and dagger unveiling of the budget firsthand. But the budget is such a big and complex thing, such a huge set piece of the political and media year, that it really deserves a kind of quite a thorough examination, deserves pausing on. That's why I was thrilled to hear that Toby Manhire, my colleague and host of the Immaculate Gone by Lunchtime podcast, is doing a budget special with Bernard Hickey, the host of our When the Facts Change podcast, and probably the most wonkish but also accessible commentator of the political economy. So I basically have decided that I'm going to give up this week's episode of The Fold to that iconic duo and let you enjoy the little break from regular transmissions. And I will be back the following week with your regularly scheduled programming. So this is Toby Manhire with Bernard Hickey on The Fold.
Tēnā koutou katoa, hello, and welcome to the special Budget Day crossover episode of When the Lunchtimes Change. My name is Toby Manhire, and with me direct from the bowels of the Parliamentary Precinct in Wellington, New Zealand, is the Grand Saint Bernard, the ode on a Grecian burn. Patching in on the burner phone, it's the big brain of the political economy, Kaka Substacker, and host of When the Facts Change, Bernard Hickey. Kia ora, Bernard.
Kia ora, Toby. Great to have you as my warm-up man, bringing me into the stadium.
Yeah, tell us, you're freshly out of the budget lockup. Give us a flavour of the room. Was the catering, I'm going to take a punt that the catering was only bread and butter.
Oh no, sausage rolls.
Oh, yeah.
This is the Chris Hipkins budget.
Okay. Yeah.
They were great good. Sausage rolls. Yeah. There was bread and butter, but there was some lettuce in there and the odd bit of chicken. But it wasn't spectacular. No, it was very much a basic budget designed to not scare the horses, not too rich, but not too dry.
No Lamingtons.
There was some Lamingtons. But there wasn't much cream.
Okay.
Yeah? But they weren't too dry, so that was okay. It's one of those budgets where if you want to get re-elected, you want to go in low, not too many risks, go in hard, and become a re-election-seeking missile and try and avoid getting shot down on the way there. And I think this budget sort of does that. There's some extra spending. There's a few little juicy things for the middle-class voter. And there's a couple of things that National will find uncomfortable to reverse. And it also doesn't have a big hairy tax change or a big amount of spending that will make middle New Zealand with a big mortgage nervous. But it is certainly going to make some people happy who may be switchy type voters, median voters.
Yeah. Okay. So let's wind back a bit there. And going into this budget, the government was facing a bunch of sort of competing gravities, really, I guess, in that it needed to avoid poking the bear of inflation or exacerbating inflation, but it also had to confront a cost of living crisis, the infrastructure deficit that had been both worsened and perhaps more to the point, exposed by Cyclone Gabrielle. And then on top of all that, the other kind of force pulling is it's an election year budget. How do you think, or maybe you can run through some of the mechanisms by which Grant Robertson and Chris Hipkins confronted that?
Yeah, I mean, your image there of Grant Robertson perched on this high wire, perhaps one of those ropes that's just above the ground where you could quite easily fall off one way or the other, is exactly right. He had to be very careful not to seem too spendy, because that's the narrative that could really hurt Labor in a year when most people who are short of money are even shorter of money, particularly if they've got a big mortgage. And for a lot of people who are the median voters in the suburbs, a little bit older, maybe with a mortgage, their main concern now is not to have more mortgage rate hikes. And the risk for Grant Robertson is if he pushed the spending too hard, the Reserve Bank would come back next week and say, you've just stimulated this economy, it's too hot already, I'm going to have to whack up mortgage rates to stop you. And that would be, I think, fatal for the government.
Sure.
If next week we were to see Adrian Orr step up and say, actually, sorry guys, we're going to have to put up interest rates a lot more because this government over the road was much too profligate, then that would be game over, I think, for the government. So they've tried to walk that path, not to be too spendy, but have enough little spendy things in there just to keep people happy.
And let's look at some of those main spendy bits, which were targeted, is I suppose the best way to put them. It wasn't working for families associated. It certainly wasn't the cost of living payments that backfired, really, last time around. They went with early childhood education extended from 3 down to 2. They went with some help on power, 100,000 more insulation, heating retrofits, one that I think they'll be hoping will really cut through or resonate with people across the borders, basically scrapping prescription costs, so the co-payment shift there, $5 down to nothing. And there was some support on transport, those sorts of things. They obviously sweated those to try and find ways that they can not look, to use your word, spendy, not look like they're stoking inflation, but still providing some support to what you spoke about before as well, which is that kind of, I'm going to use the phrase, squeeze middle.
Yes, that's right.
Sorry.
You're exactly right. And you can see the targeting that's going on here. Again, October 14 targeting missile, it is all about handing some money over to those people who are most likely to be in that target zone. And who doesn't love a two-year-old, especially when they're in early childhood education?
Especially when they're in the kindergarten, yeah.
That's right. And, you know, it's good for kids. It's good for mum and dad, or mum and mum, or dad and dad, in that they can go to work and pay some taxes and make a little bit of extra money to pay the mortgage. So that looks good. And for National now, they have a bit of a problem in that they, to, you know, save the money to stop this Labor thing, they'd have to promise to get rid of it, which means that they're being mean to two-year-olds and they're being mean to young families, which, of course, you don't want to do if you're trying to win power. Secondly, you've got this extra 100,000 homes to be insulated and heat pumped. Mm. And the way they're doing that is essentially to lift the means testing, the income and asset test, so that someone who has a reasonably good-looking house that's worth a lot of money can now get a government subsidy to put in a heat pump or to put in some insulation. It's 100,000, which is a lot, but it's not the sort of, you know, 1 million, 1.2 million homes that would actually make a huge difference on the climate. But for those people who maybe haven't yet taken advantage of the subsidies, they'll be there, and that'll make people feel better, particularly as we go into the winter. And then you've got the very slight amount of money for people who are on paid parental leave, a little bit of a top-up for KiwiSaver. So that will please people. And then for the sort of centre-left, you know, the sort of base of Labor and Green support, the $5 prescription fee removal is a really sensible and effective way to give benefits to people who really, really need it, and also reduce the number of calls on waiting, the number of calls on A&E rooms this winter, because I think actually a winter collapse of our A&E departments is the biggest risk to this government going into the October 14 election. Mm-hmm. And anything they can do to stop people turning up at A&E, perhaps because they couldn't afford the prescription, as we know, over 130,000 people didn't collect their prescriptions in 2021-22 simply because of that $5 fee. And the research shows that this is not only good for people on low incomes who need the prescriptions, but it takes pressure off the health system. So it's a win-win-win. And actually, I think the best policy to come out of this budget.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oOh!media for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
What about on tax? The trust income tax rate has been bumped up, I think, from 33 to 39, if I have that right. And that's, we were told no major tax changes. That probably doesn't really qualify as major. Where is it? Somewhere in between.
Well, the numbers are quite large over 4 years. We're talking at $1.1 billion. And I think they can get away with it politically after that big report a few weeks ago from IRD showing that the country's 311 richest families should have paid an extra $3 billion in taxes in 2022-23.
If their assets were being taxed, you mean?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And a lot of the income was being funneled through trusts. And one of the big interesting numbers to be thrown out in the budget today was from Grant Robertson saying that 78% of the income that goes through trusts goes through just 5% of the trusts. Mm. So that means that the targeting of the tax increase on the 5% of people who have trusts will be hard to reverse. So it's going to be hard for Christopher Luxon to stand up and say, I'm here protecting those with trusts who are not paying enough, who are paying too much tax. Well, they're paying tax at the 39-cent rate, which is for those people earning more than $180,000. And it's pretty clear from that IRD research that came out from David Parker a couple of weeks ago that there's an awful lot of money that isn't being taxed and using existing tax laws and existing structures to go after the trusts is not only good politics, but it's good economics in that it reduces the gap between the trust rate and the top tax rate, which in the past has been used as a hole to jump through. And actually, John Key and Bill English made a point when they did their big tax switch in 2011 of aligning the trust rate with the top personal tax rate. So again, sort of manoeuvring National and ACT into a corner saying, go on then, you defend the richest 5% of the country.
Mm. And interesting in Christopher Luxon's response in the House, which is always a tricky one, I think, for an opposition leader to come in cold when the others have had all this material and been sitting on it for a long time. But there wasn't much, if any, going through the specifics. It was just really a cut and paste of existing attack lines. He didn't really dare go hard or anything above the sort of generality of a blowout budget.
Yeah, you can see it was a bunch of retreads put together into a tire that didn't really hit the mark, because you're right, it is really hard to move on your feet and make calls, because really you've got 4 or 5 months of election campaigning, and if you decide in the space of 30 minutes to commit your party one way or the other. That can be quite difficult. But again, that's the game. And some of those natural reflexes you have as a politician show voters and your opponents exactly how good you are. Mm. I mean, there's nothing more impressive than a politician who's able to think on their feet and counterpunch in a really effective way without, you know, firstly going to a focus group and then talking to Topham Gear and having a chat with the Business Roundtable or whatever, actually using your own instincts in Parliament to make the right call. That's the game, because if you get into government as a Prime Minister, there's going to be a lot of those times when you do have to use your instincts and make the right calls, and when you do, there won't be anyone watching.
Coming back a bit to the sort of big themes of the budget, and it was there. Well, it was there in the title, wasn't it? Support for today, building for tomorrow. You know, the dual challenges, and you've talked a lot in your writing and in your podcast about the infrastructure deficit. It's a very real challenge. It was laid bare in a devastating fashion for us earlier this year in New Zealand. Was there enough of, if we've talked about the support for today, but already, the building for tomorrow, did you see enough in the budget to give you confidence that that infrastructure deficit is being confronted?
Not in an overarching way. Certainly there were a couple of big ticket items that are in there, mainly around Kāinga Ora, actually. Mm. So one of the things that I was looking for in this budget was what was the government going to do about Kāinga Ora? Because the Kāinga Ora actually came to the government last year, in June last year, in a cabinet paper and said, hey guys, we've got our pipeline ready and working out to the end of June 2024. That was the program you gave us when you came into government. Essentially, 2018, the government told Kāinga Ora, hey, you need to build net 14,000 houses over the next 4 years or so. And they went and did that. And there's been a lot of building, and there's still some building to go. But by the end of June 2024, the funding was due to run out. And the big question was, what would the government do? Would they simply say to Kāinga, well, that's it, we've built enough houses, you can finish up now? Or what is more likely is that Kāinga Ora would keep building to keep a pipeline going, but essentially sell all the houses it builds back into the private market, which wouldn't add to the net housing stock. And this is super important. Obviously, we have a massive housing shortage. It's the core reason, basically, for everything. Our poverty, our housing unaffordability, the reasons young Kiwis are flying off to Australia at a great rate, the reason that there's a whole bunch of landlords who, even though they've had some tax benefits removed, are still able to make money. This is one of the awful things about the Loafers Lodge fire, which is a refocused attention on this issue, is that that building, which is a crappy old office building, built in the 70s and then reconfigured in the 90s as a lodge, a...
Hostel.
Hostel, yeah. A boarding house, basically.
Yeah.
Makes $1 million a year in rent from 94 rooms. And that's why it was valuable. And this is the guts of it. We have extraordinarily high rents. They are the highest in the world relative to incomes. And our house prices are the highest relative to incomes. And what we've just learned is that the Reserve Bank effectively intervened a month or so ago to stop house prices falling by relaxing some of the LVRs. And it's clear from what we've seen in the auction rooms and around the markets in the last couple of weeks that the market has bottomed out. And even though it's clearly still unaffordable, the Reserve Bank has started saying that house prices are now sustainable because they're unlikely to fall too much further simply because of the dysfunction in our market. Now, that's important because the only way to really solve this problem is to add new supply, particularly at the bottom, you know, social housing end of the market. And Kongaroo is the main game in town. It is the thing the government bet on. It is the core, you could argue, of what the government's trying to do. So what was it going to do after the end of June next year? And so it came out and added one more year of new house building, so an extra net 3,000 homes. So that keeps the track going, but only for that year. And when you look at the capital spending profile for the next 4 years and beyond, essentially the government whacks a whole bunch of spending in there in the next 2 years for Kongaroo and for reconstruction from the cyclones, and then turns off the tap. And when you look at the government spending on investment in the second half of the four-year period, it really dribbles away to nothing, and that's all about making sure the net debt track, which is going to peak at about 24% of GDP and then track down towards 19%, 18% by the end of the period. It actually, in a longer-term forecast that Treasury included, goes down to under 10% of GDP by 2037. Mm. And when you think about the intergenerational problems we have, the things that only can be dealt with by hundreds of billions of dollars of investment over the next 10 to 20 years, the government's not doing that. The reason it's not doing it is that it wants to keep that net debt low and keep the size of government low, down towards that 30% of GDP level. And that allows, with low public debt, for investors to have high private debt, high mortgages, to get those juicy, leveraged, tax-free capital gains. It is the rotting heart of our political economy, and it's not been cut out here.
The Bernard classic theme coming back to there, everything returns to, hey, on the, you talked about some of those projected numbers and how close to get to the debt ceiling or whatever. What else? I mean, that's a big part of budget day. Apart from here's what we're going to spend and how we're going to spend it, we get all these numbers from Treasury saying here's how we see the near medium future. Was there anything in there that interested you? We got, for example, I think based on those numbers, they're saying probably will avoid by the skin of our teeth a recession, and that we won't get those two quarters of retraction in a row. Anything? I mean, is that interesting? Anything else of note in there?
Yeah, I think the no recession call is a reasonably big one, because there's a bunch of other economists who think that there will be a recession. Mm. And whenever you have a really sharp tightening of monetary policy, so much higher interest rates, often that inevitably leads to a recession. And most people think there's going to be a recession in the United States. Europe seems to have avoided one also by the skin of its teeth, thanks to a warm winter. And it would be unusual for New Zealand not to have a recession after such a tightening of monetary policy. So that is interesting. And the other thing that will be a subject of controversy and interest amongst fiscal and monetary policy geeks like me, and which I don't think is going to burst through to this sort of main public debate, is that Treasury...
Give it a go. Now.
So the headline here is that Treasury thinks the government's budget is slightly more inflationary than it said it was in December. So slightly more inflationary in the next year or two, but slightly less inflationary over the full four-year period. So we can have an interesting debate on the primetime news about the first half of the fiscal outlook and the second half of the fiscal outlook, and whether or not you think the fiscal impulse numbers accurately reflect the, you know, effects of loose fiscal policy on monetary policy. If, you know, Adrian Orr comes out next week and says, hey, we've seen the budget. The government has blown it. They have gone too hard, and we're going to have to whack them on the head with an interest rate hike. Game over. I think it's very unlikely he'd do that. Apart from anything else, Adrian Orr doesn't want to work for Nicola Willis, and she doesn't want him to work for her.
He needs to. Who knows what he's going to do with our jets next week? He might just sort of warm them slightly.
Are we going to?
A warm towel over them just to get the turbines turning. Who knows? And briefly, really, this is an election year. Has Grant Robertson left some cash, stuffed some cash down the mattress? I mean, there's going to be more to come before we hit election day in mid-October, isn't there? Maybe more casting in terms of future spending. What are you expecting?
Yeah, I think he's emptied the back of the couch as much as he can, and he really can't promise in the election campaign any big new spending. He could promise tax increases, because that would be one way to cool the economy down. And that it's interesting that the tone of his language in the last couple of days coming up to the budget was, hey, I'm actually up for a debate about tax in this election. And, you know, there must have been a frozen look that passed across Chris Hipkins' face when he heard that. But, you know, there were questions about wealth. We heard that we had that poll this week from News Hub Research.
That poll, though, Bernard, that poll was, people were asked whether or not they supported a wealth tax, weren't they? And I think the issue is that when they get asked whether they want a capital gains tax, all they hear is, No matter how much you say not the family home, it's suddenly kryptonite, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's a bit like wealth tax. That means, oh, that's taxing other people, other wealthy people. I'm not wealthy.
No.
Capital gains tax. Oh my God, they better not be the family home or my three rental properties. That's a different thing. So I think you're right. It's one of those polls where the language you use and the way it's phrased will determine the result. And if you were the likes of the Labor pollsters, you would be wary of that, because you'd focus group that properly and you would do the multi-choice questions and the multi-choice answers to zero in on what people will accept or not. I think you're right. CGT is not just a third rail. It's a poison pill and anything else you want to use.
And we've seen it. We've seen it over and over again from Show Me the Money onwards, if not before. Just quickly again on tax, though, I was slightly surprised watching Christopher Luxon's response that he hasn't spoken in the way they did more months ago. They were more focused on bracket creep, you know, which is this very real, you know, not is it 2010 since they were last adjusted? We've had quite a lot of inflation since then, and we've got people in the middle to lower incomes being, you know, on the escalator up through the brackets, through the marginal rates, and that does really, I mean, and accordingly, the coffers of the public coffers swell. It does seem something that is ripe for discussion in terms of the pressures of cost of living.
And every year you leave it unaddressed, the bill gets higher. So because it's now 13 years since the thresholds were indexed, to do a catch-up, a full catch-up now, would I understand, cost $6 billion. Mm. And lost income tax. So you'd have to do some sort of limited catch-up. And then you'd have to make the consequential decision about whether to index it. And even Bill English and John Key were reluctant to take that step. I mean, it's no accident that the thing didn't change between 2010 and 2017. Yeah. And it's something that everyone goes back to. But I think one of the reasons it's still in place is that we've got a fundamental problem here, in that a significant chunk of the activity and the, you know, momentum in the economy, the sort of critical mass of it, is not being taxed. We tax PAYE income, we tax spending, and we also, you know, tax corporate profits, but we're just not taxing capital gains, and in particular land, and we're also not taxing inheritance. And the longer this goes on, the more weight you have to put onto the other forms of tax, and in this case it's PAYE income tax, and no doubt the pressure will come on GST at some point as well, because this week we've heard from Standard & Poor's and Moody's that they believe the aging populations of the developed world will require them to downgrade a whole bunch of developed countries to junk by 2040 or so. Now, we're the most attractive-looking horse in the knacker's yard when it comes to debt. But still, when you actually have a look through the budget, and it will get no attention in the papers this week or on the bulletins this week, when you look at what was the biggest growth line in government spending, mm-hmm. and not just by a little bit, by billions.
You're going to say superannuation.
Exactly. And even faster than health costs. So, you know, again, this is a thing that we've all given up on this as a third rail as well. I wonder how many third rails you can possibly have. But, you know, superannuation is the real blowout cost here. And it's one of the drivers, I think, for this obsession we have with relatively high net migration. It's the one way we can keep our population young is just to import lots of people, young people.
Well, before we return to those themes any further, well, there's plenty of time to do that in the months to come, whether or not it becomes an election issue or not. You're right, it's probably not. I did hear actually Hipkins in his speech third up today actually had a go at the National and NAC parties for wanting to meddle with superannuation. So it's certainly not coming from that quarter. But Bernard will be back, normal service on when the facts change, gone by lunchtime, we'll be back. We might even be putting this on the fold feed. What do you call it? Is that right, Samuel? It could be on the real pod. I don't know. It could be anything. let's go, Duncan. Talking about Duncan, because did you see, Bernard, that his in the budget lockup, his name tag was printed with the spin-off, and then it said Duncan Grieveson. Is that right?
Absolutely, because my good partner and editor and graphic designer, Lynn Grieveson, was also in the lockup. So Grieveson and Grieve, actually the E and the I are differently spelt in both, and but then, obviously a transposition.
And then, and not just that, Bernard, but Lynn apparently was given a spin-off badge. Did you see that? She was Lynn Grieves in the spinoff, which does, if I'm right, that's two devastating blows for you in one, isn't it? You've lost your colleague and you've lost your life partner.
That's right. Although, luckily for me, she does appear on the spinoff regularly as a Getty Images contributor.
Fantastic photographer, fantastic. Cheers to Lynn, the true star of Budget 2023, Lynn Grieveson. Yeah. Lovely to talk to you, Bernard. Thank you very much, Samuel, for making this happen. And we'll all be back on our normal feeds and behaving ourselves shortly.
Kia kite anō.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.